This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. Caring for those who care for you. For more information, check out nhhca.org. We're with Paul Steinhauser here at the State House, which has been very busy over the last 2.5 weeks. And we had a surprise visitor. We're going to hear from the second segment. Here is Deval Patrick, filed for the First Nation presidential primary today. Elizabeth Warren yesterday. And I thought his rationale for his candidacy, taking some shots at Elizabeth Warren and Joe Biden, although he did not directly say that he was, actually he did directly say he didn't want to be a pundit, but he was a pundit.
He was a pundit.
He provided some very good analysis in regards to them. And he sees Joe Biden as being a candidate that is presenting nostalgia. And he sees Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders as presenting a divisive candidacy that's going to have difficulty in the general election because their ideas do not have any sort of consensus support, which we all know. But the question is Deval Patrick the candidate that can step in and bridge that gap? Because it seems like Pete Buttigieg is that candidate right now, if you look at the polling.
Yeah, Pete Buttigieg is that candidate. There are others saying the same thing. Think Amy Klobuchar to a degree. Think Cory Booker, two U.S. senators who've been in this campaign a long time, who've already built up strong organizations in these early voting states like New Hampshire and Iowa. Deval Patrick's argument is, listen, the voters haven't made up their minds yet. And you know what? He's right. You look at the latest polling here and in Iowa, and a majority still say they are undecided or they're backing somebody. But guess what? They could change their mind. We got 2.5 months to go till the voting kicks off. So Deval, Patrick's argument isn't that far-fetched. He also made a little bit of news there saying he would not rule out a super PAC. Remember, Joe Biden has been pummeled by rivals for, allowing at least an outside group, a super PAC, to raise big amounts of money for him, which that group is doing. Deval Patrick, he can't rule one out. He needs that help right now. He's never going to be able to raise the money he needs in just 2 months till the voting begins. So, yeah, making some news on the super PAC. But again, as you said, didn't want to play the pundit. Yes, he did. He took his shots. He knew what he was doing. He knew exactly what he was doing. He was getting that message out. This is the first time he's in front of cameras just hours after announcing his bid.
And perhaps the longest, if not the longest, press conference as well. Again, we'll condense that and give some of the best moments from that coming up the next segment of the program. But the question, again, is can he get into this? And you make great point, as he did, the fact that most voters have not made up their minds. But there is an infrastructure and a recognition that exists if you've been in the race for a long period of time. Deval Patrick was governor of Massachusetts for five years ago, for two terms, and I think is still well-known here in New Hampshire. And I think polling will indicate that there's a small appetite for his candidacy. But the work is going to have to go in to building that number up over a period of time without probably appearing on a debate stage.
Yeah, he doesn't have a prayer to make. Obviously, he's not going to make the debate next week. It would be an incredibly tall task for him to make the December 19th debate just before Christmas. He's got to raise a lot of money fast. Yeah, he has name recognition here. He's known here. Didn't spend a lot of time coming up here when he was governor helping New Hampshire Democrats out, though. And you've got, obviously, neighboring state senators who are much more well-known here. And let's be honest, the former vice president, extremely well-known here. Cory Booker has been here nonstop. Amy Klobuchar has been here a bunch. Pete Buttigieg gets huge crowds when he's here nowadays. So this is what he's up against. He's making some great arguments. He had a pretty good track record in Boston as he ran Massachusetts. But even he admits it. It's a Herculean task, and he's got a long way to go, and he's getting in late in the game.
So he appears here at the State House. Tom Steyer was here earlier this week. My conversation with him in just a little bit. I rode the bus with Pete Buttigieg across the Granite State on Saturday. Parts of that rolling conversation with him as well. And Joe Walsh came to First Nation primary state to sign up for the primary, and a conversation with him as well a little bit later on in the program. Let's talk a little about the Republican side of things, because there isn't a really Republican side of things at this point. Walsh was here. He was bombastic. He made big arguments. He spoke about Trump in very Trumpian terms. But it just doesn't seem that there's an appetite for a primary at this point in time amongst Republicans. And, you know, we saw Mark Sanford pretty much say that in one of the is understated and perhaps just going to be a blip in New Hampshire primary history, but a pretty interesting moment as a check for one of those big checks for $1 trillion outside. And so, by the way, I'm not going to be filing for office like it was on Friday. And that was earlier this week, I believe, on Tuesday.
Yep, it was that Mark Sanford announcing he was dropping and suspending his bid because of impeachment. He said he could. His main reason for running was to strike up a conversation in the Republican Party, which doesn't exist right now, over the debt and deficit and how it's crushing this country. He blamed impeachment, saying all the oxygen has been sucked out of the room. After Walsh filed, I sat down and another reporter sat down with him, and I asked him specifically, do you buy that argument from Mark Sanford? He said he loves Mark Sanford, but he says no, he doesn't buy it. He thinks just the opposite. And Bill Weld told us this the day before as well, the other Republican running, that impeachment helps their campaigns, makes their case even more. Listen, Walsh is very entertaining. Weld has been up here every week. They're not going anywhere. Let's be honest. In a Republican primary, primary up here, where most independents are not going to be voting in that primary. Right. They're coming to the Democratic side. That's where the action is. Neither of these guys has a chance here, and I doubt they have a chance in Iowa or elsewhere.
So let's think back to a year ago. And, you know, the Mueller report was still a big topic of conversation. How is that going to end? There was a potential for impeachment. And now this is all taking place. The Mueller report obviously did not have the, you know, the goods, quote unquote, to drive the impeachment of the president, but the Ukrainian call did. Are you surprised that there are not any significant Republicans who have decided to primary Trump, you know, given, because I, even a year ago, like, I didn't really think that we were going to see anyone step forward unless the president was extremely damaged amongst Republicans. And that has not happened. Republicans have pretty much had his back or are going to remain silent during the course of this process. So I'm not surprised, despite Trump's lack of popularity across the wide scope of the country, that there is not a significant Republican primary challenge to Trump.
Yeah. Listen, we saw this with the Tea Party movement back at the beginning of this decade. Republicans moved further to the right because they were terrified of being primary challenged. Republicans in safe congressional districts, Republicans in safe U.S. Senate seats were terrified that the far right of their party, at that time fueled by the Tea Party movement, would come against them, and that would be their bigger threat. They knew they were going to win the general election. Now, it's even more magnified. This is Donald Trump's party, and they're not terrified of the Tea Party anymore. They're terrified of Trump supporters, that more populist base now, that if they cross the president, they will be crushed by these people. So I'm not surprised that anybody of major significance hasn't spoken out. There's a Mitt Romney. There's a few other senators that will do that, but you know they're pretty safe. So not surprised. The only thing, and listen, this is the case that Weld makes and this is the case that Walsh makes, is that when voters go in there, Republican voters, it's a secret ballot. So though, even with that argument, I don't see anything likely right now, except we still don't know how this is going to end on impeachment. I mean, we would have believed that the U.S. House, dominated by Democrats, will impeach him. But when it gets to the U.S. Senate, are 20 Republicans going to cross the aisle? Probably not. But if they did, huge if, then it would be a very different story.
Yeah, absolutely. And that trial will likely be taking place in January, just around the time for the First Nation primary to be taking place. That is Paul Steinhauser. I'm Chris Ryan. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. We're at the State House where all the action has been. And Deval Patrick's surprise candidacy came to fruition earlier in the day here on Thursday and was completely confirmed by him signing up for the First Nation presidential primary here later on the day. We hear from Deval Patrick next. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Ryan. Well, Deval Patrick is the newest entrant into the Democratic presidential race. It seems like some go and some come. That's been kind of the way this has gone. The field has not gotten much smaller as individuals continue to get into this primary process. But, of course, in order to sign up for New Hampshire, you have to do it by Friday at 5 p.m. Patrick beat that deadline and met with the media, including Paul Steinhauser.
I have lived my American dream. But I know, and you know, and all of your viewers and listeners know, that the American dream has become more and more out of reach over time. It has gotten worse under the leadership of our current president, but it didn't start under the leadership of our current president. We have been disinvesting, walking away, giving up on investing our time and our ideas and our money in the kinds of things that enable people to lift themselves and their families to a better life. So that in many respects, the anger and the anxiety that I see abroad all around America is not only justified, but it's familiar. It's familiar. Because I can remember what it felt like when the steel mills closed and left people feeling like the economy had sort of just gotten up and left us behind on the South Side. I remember what it felt like and looked like when opioids came to fill that void in my own home, let alone the neighborhood. And I remember what it felt like and still do and did throughout my adult years and in my campaigns for governor of Massachusetts and in service, to have people's issues come to the top of the agenda during the campaign and then vanish in between the campaigns. And I think that there is a sort of once-in-a-lifetime appetite today to bring big solutions, big enough for the challenges we face. But I think that there has to be more than the big solutions. We have to use those solutions to heal us. We have a really, really talented, marvelous Democratic field. Many of them are my friends. I talk to some of them regularly. They have made me proud to be a Democrat. But in many ways, it has felt to me, watching the race unfold, that we're beginning to break into sort of camps of nostalgia on the one hand and big ideas sort of my way or no way on the other. And I think we have to be about how we bring people in, how we bring people along, and how we yield to the possibility that somebody else or even some other party may have a good idea as good or better than our own. That's the kind of leadership I have brought to settings in the private sector and the public sector, the kind of leadership I want to bring right now. With that, I am just, I'm excited. I am humbled, and I am fired up to launch my candidacy for President of the United States.
Governor, at the end of your video this morning, you put out, you call for a future not built for you, but with you. And I'm wondering if I'm reading that as maybe a criticism of your fellow Bay Stater Elizabeth Warren and Senator Bernie Sanders, who are pushing big government ideas.
Well, first of all, I want to acknowledge my friendship and enormous respect, in particular with Senator Warren. I talked to her last night, and I think it was a kind of a hard conversation for both of us, frankly. I don't know Senator Sanders as well, but I credit him in large measure for bringing the question of Medicare for All to a more popular, meaning more broad-based discussion, a Ted Kennedy idea, actually. So each of them have contributed to improving our dialogue and, frankly, our ambition as Democrats, and that's a terrific, terrific thing. But I think that if we want solutions that last, they can't be solutions that feel to the voting public as if they are just Democratic solutions. I am proud of the fact that we as a party and that the field of Democratic candidates have committed ourselves to universal care, to really delivering health care that is affordable and of high quality to everybody, and having done this for 98% of the residents in the Commonwealth, I understand there is more than one way to skin that cat. And so, you know, saying that, I guess I would put it this way. We spent, let's see, Governor Romney signed our health reform bill before he left office, and it took effect the day I took office. This is one of the things that Carmen will remember. I used to hate it being called Romney Care. It should be called Patrick Care.
This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. Up next, we ride on the bus with Pete Buttigieg and talk about signing up for the primary with Tom Steyer. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Ryan. I appreciate you joining us for the show. Pete Buttigieg drove across the Granite State in his campaign bus for 4 days this past weekend and on Veterans Day. And I joined him on Saturday, and it was a wide range of topics of conversation with Buttigieg. Here's some of that conversation, including my back and forth with him. Here is that on the campaign bus with Pete Buttigieg.
I wanted to start out with the Bloomberg strategy of skipping the early primary states and your thoughts on that.
I mean, I can't speak to anybody else's strategy, but I can tell you about ours, which is that the early primary states are critical. I think that the four states, New Hampshire, Iowa, South Carolina, and Nevada, present, first of all, an opportunity to cut through the kind of airwaves version of campaigning, right? This is where people get to see you on the ground, in person, having those human moments and human interactions that can only happen when you cut the race down to size by doing it in one state at a time. And it's also, I think, the best way for a party that wants to know that our nominee can take on Donald Trump. It's the best way to show that you are capable of winning over voters and actually succeeding at the polls. So for us, it's absolutely central, but I'll let others figure out their own strategies as they see fit.
But what does it mean that you have a celebrity, a billionaire, who's saying, I'm going to circumvent that process, and I'm going to go and do exactly what you're saying not to do, and just use the airwaves and fly across the early states?
Look, I think campaigning is a very human process, and on our campaign, the most important and maybe to some extent the most revealing moments come in the backyards and in the barns and in the environments where a voter, or sometimes a child not even old enough to vote, can look you in the eye and ask a question or come up to you afterwards and tell you why they care about these issues and how they impact their lives. And I know for our campaign, it just wouldn't... it wouldn't work for us if we weren't able to do that, because I wouldn't have the chance to demonstrate who we are.
What were your feelings on the New York Times article, which looked at the aspirational aspect of your campaign and said that this is something that your rivals don't like, that you don't have the experience, the wherewithal to be president?
Well, I'm nothing if not aspirational. And... you know, I'm not going to get into the inside baseball stuff. I doubt that that's going to be a question on any voter's mind as we go around New Hampshire. I think the point and the beauty of the campaign, especially as it comes through the early states, the campaign process, is that everyone gets a chance to compete, including relative newcomers and outsiders. Now, I can talk about how I've had 8 years of experience as an elected official in my hometown. So I'm not coming out of the blue, but I'm certainly a newcomer to the national scene. I'm coming from outside Washington. I think that's an asset.
Do you think voters are rejecting, you know, that type of a candidate like a Elizabeth Warren or an individual that's been in office for a long period of time? With Barack Obama and Donald Trump, voters said these two individuals who have very limited experience in government were going to select them.
Yeah, one very strong pattern that you've seen, especially for Democrats, is that we win the White House when we put forward somebody who represents a fresh start. And there's such frustration with Washington right now. I think there's a bipartisan frustration with Washington's inability to solve so many basic problems. That I think the idea the idea of bringing a governing style to Washington instead of from Washington is resonating more than ever with voters.
Do you remember the Times moment where Biden condescendingly referred to you as Mr. President, and what effect did that have on you? Do you remember?
He has, just to be clear, he has always been wonderful to interact with on the trail. And by the way, we all interact really well, the candidates. Yes, it's a competition, but I'm really proud to be part of this field. I mean, this is the most diverse and in so many ways most wide-ranging and capable field of candidates we've ever put forward.
But do you remember really that specific moment at all or not?
I remember lots of interactions that have been unfailingly kind and pleasant.
One of the concerns I've heard a lot from independent voters here in the state is concern over massive structural change to the economy. You've addressed this a little with Medicare for All, but I'm curious as to what you're your takeaways are in regards to that, and what you've heard from voters, and how you assure them that a Democrat that you elected as president would not result in a structural change that would leave the country unrecognizable to some independents.
Yeah, I think the important thing is to be really clear about what we're offering and what we're not. So everything that I put forward, it makes sense in the context of a healthier version of capitalism than what we have now. And it is important to make that clear. This is not anti-business. This is about ensuring that corporate America is not out of control, and that individuals and families and small businesses and communities have more relative power than we do right now. And it's also consistent with where America has been at our most effective moments, I think. In other words, there's nothing exotic about the level of public investment or the level of taxation that I'm proposing. And I think it's important to be clear for that reason, so people can really see it, understand the dimensions of what we're proposing, see that it's big and that it's meaningful, but that it is not a fundamental replacement of the American system. It's a big improvement to it.
Do you see that?
And then this is the last one, and then we got to get going because.
Do you see Senator Warren and Senator Sanders offering something that is a complete structural change? And should there be a reticence amongst independents and perhaps all Americans in regards to what they're offering?
I think different people will see different things. But what I see is a way to an attempt to address these problems that could be addressed with less cost and less upheaval. And so to me, it's about being bold enough to fix the problem, but I think our solutions do that without having to explain how you would take sums of money equivalent to the entire GDP of the U.S. and push them through the Treasury.
A couple process questions. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you're polling in
Iowa. And we just got a couple more minutes on camera.
Polling well in Iowa, New Hampshire, and then polling drops off after that. Do you expect that results in Iowa and New Hampshire are going to automatically lead to results in those states? Or how do you view that your path to nomination beyond strong finishes in Iowa and New Hampshire?
I think Iowa and New Hampshire can really help, for sure, because a lot of voters in Nevada and South Carolina are looking for a convincing message. I think we've got that. They're also looking for engagement. That's the work we got to go do. And they're looking for a sense of viability, which you can demonstrate in the very first states. And then the other thing that drops off as you get out of these states is just how well I'm known, just whether people literally even know who I am. Mm-hmm. And so part of that's from getting out there on the ground, part of that's from the national conversation continuing. But part of there's a huge boost in that if we can succeed here.
Do you think your viability here in Iowa and New Hampshire could be adversely affected by people here looking ahead and saying, okay, he could do well here, but South Carolina, Nevada, and beyond that, we see him polling in a different place?
I think, the kind of voter is pundit phenomenon, like the politician is pundit phenomenon, right? Kind of creates a lot of problems because you can just psych yourself out. I think my job is to convince voters here that I'd be the best president, and if I can do that, then I'll succeed here.
As we traveled from Franklin to New Hampton, the conversation got much more personal. We talked about theology and also Buttigieg being bullied and always feeling different even prior to coming out as a homosexual. We talked about that and how he has always felt different.
I've always felt different. Some things kicked in sooner than others, but I think I've always been conscious of that in some way.
At what point did you develop the kind of the comfort and ease that we see in you today? Because you don't reflect an individual that has any discomfort with identity or who you are or anything of that nature. What point did that kind of click in for you? Is there still that self-doubt that perhaps occurred earlier?
I think it never completely goes away. Especially when you're in campaigning and politics, which is so much about, just when you reach the maturity in life not to worry about what others think of you, it's literally your job to persuade others to believe certain things about you are true. But I've also found, and I think throughout my adult life, have felt that the more I can be open and kind of connected with myself, the easier relationships get. Mm-hmm. Whether it's a relationship with somebody that is close to me, or the relationship you form with somebody when they're coming to see you at a town hall or watching you on TV. And I think one of the ways that you can kind of handle the work of having people get to know you is to make sure that the you that's out there is as effortless as it can be, so that you're not exhausting yourself trying to be something or someone that you're not.
Do you feel the you that's out there and is being projected is, in fact, you internally in terms of how you're being projected?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the reality is we all respond to our surroundings in different ways, right? Like the you that gets out of bed in the morning versus the you that's dealing with a tough customer at work versus the you that's you know, got your loved ones in your arms. I mean, there's all these different kind of parts of us that come out, but I think you've got to bring your whole self to campaigning, or else you exhaust yourself and people will see through it.
Kasich was up here the other night, and somebody in the audience asked him, you know, would you serve as Joe Biden's vice president? He said it wouldn't happen, but I'd consider it. I mean, would you pick a Republican or somebody like a John Kasich as a unity type ticket?
I don't see a world where it would make sense to have a Republican on a Democratic ticket. When we're talking about building the broader leadership team for the future, I think diversity of thought is important.
All right, that is South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg, who has emerged as one of the front runners for the Democratic nomination for president. Tom Steyer signed up for the First Nation presidential primary on Tuesday. He's been a frequent visitor to the First Nation primary state, and I talked with him after he signed up.
Joined by Tom Steyer, who just signed up for the First Nation presidential primary. And first of all, what was that like for you? Been around politics for a long time now, and putting your name on the ballot to be a candidate here in New Hampshire, what did that mean to you?
Look, it's exciting and fun, honestly. I mean, I set out to do this. This is an important milestone. Honestly, the biggest part for me was walking past all those Civil War flags full of holes from bullets.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, okay, here we go in terms of really working for the country. I thought that was very moving and important.
And that's an interesting point, because you have always felt like you are in the fight here. Obviously, it's different put your life on the line to fight for the nation. But you have always been very engaged in the advocacy side of things and pushing the envelope as much as possible to create democratic change. When did that start to really fester within you?
Look, I think I started to get much more active when I realized what a bad president George W. Bush was.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think he was necessarily a bad man. I thought he was a dangerous president who was dangerous for the country. And I had not expected that. I wasn't for him, but I thought he would be an adequate president. I thought he would be like his father.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized in about a year or two, oh my gosh, this is totally out of control. And I thought, I'm not going to respect myself if I'm sitting around and I've watched the country go to hell in a handbasket and I've done nothing. I'm not going to respect myself. I don't think my kids are going to respect me. I don't think my grandchildren are going to respect me. I'm just not going to stand by. And that's exactly how I feel now, is there are things going on here that are wrong. I don't think they're being adequately addressed. I know that climate is no one else's first priority. No one else really wants to reform Washington, D.C. They may want. And so it's like, can't stand by.
So Mike Bloomberg is looking at getting into this race, and there's been a lot of discussion about how he's looking to buy his way into the process by foregoing the first four early primaries and caucus states. You had the same accusations alleged against you, but engaged in the first four contests and plan to. Would you do anything differently, and what do you think of Bloomberg's strategy?
My opinion about it, what I've said about Mike is this. If he wants to run, he has every right to do so. I think it's incumbent on him to embrace a wealth tax. I had proposed one more than a year ago, long before I was running for president, because I feel as if inequality is a huge issue. in the United States. It's a defining issue. It's got to be addressed. And if you really want to be the standard bearer for the Democratic Party, you have to address inequality in this country, and you pretty much have to address, you have to accept and champion the idea of a wealth tax, because there's something wrong here in terms of the inequality, and for especially for people like him or like me who've been particularly lucky and have benefited from all the advantages of being an American, I think it's incumbent on us especially to do the right thing and point out that this has to change.
At what point did you make the decision to invest the way that you have in digital media? Because there's always been that debate as to, do you go traditional advertising or do you go digital advertising? And a lot of individuals in politics have been reticent to go on the digital advertising. We talked about the last time my kids and the kids in their class watch YouTube and they know Tom Steyer's videos top to bottom. So what made you decide to do that? Because you, in my view, digital is and radio, obviously, is the way to go.
Radio's the best, Chris.
Let's not kid about this. Radio is clearly the best. But yeah, I mean, digital advertising, in my view, makes perfect sense, but campaigns are traditionally reticent to go all in on digital like you have.
But remember who you're talking to. You know, I started Next Gen America, the largest youth voter mobilization outfit in American history. So we've been dealing, you know, overwhelmingly with people between the ages of 18 and 35. Mm-hmm. You know, that is their medium. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of not participating there makes no sense in the 21st century, honestly. So think about it. I mean, we did the largest youth voter mobilization in American history last year. Mm-hmm. We were specifically reaching out to people, you know, between 18 and 35. We couldn't have done it if we weren't online, if we weren't using, you know, the web.
Final couple things here. Want to talk to you about your path, as you view it, to the nomination. You have four individuals that are in the lead here in Hampshire and in Iowa, but their lead is tenuous. Bernie really seems to be the only individual that has locked-in support, so it can move. How do you move individuals in your direction outside of the advertising approach that you've had? Do you think the debates are going to do it? What do you think is going to be able to create?
I think it's really a matter of just consistently saying what I'm saying. I mean, I'm not a famous person, Chris.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not. So a lot of this for me is name recognition, mm-hmm. and then having people understand what I'm saying, that I'm fighting this corporate takeover and that climate's my number one priority, mm-hmm. and I'm a successful business person who knows how to run the economy. And saying that over and over, and then having people take a look at me. You know, I did a town hall on TV on Sunday night, so people can look at me and see what kind of person I am. And so I think there's nothing, you know, there's no replacement for going out and looking people in the eye and doing it over and over and over again so they can see. And that's what they should do, and that's why the primary process is so important. So that in those early states, people in Manchester and Concord and Nashua, you know, actually get a chance to think, does that seem like a reasonable, honest, decent, tough person who will fight for me and my family?
How much of your candidacy is rooted in the fact that you've become frustrated with the way that Washington politicians do not work? Because you've spent time advocating in the hope that change was going to come as a result of electing individuals, whether it's on issues or on impeachment. How much of your candidacy was driven by basically anger of, if no one else is going to do this, I'm going to do it?
Well, we have a broken government.
Mm.
That's probably the single biggest thesis of my campaign, that Washington is broken, that it's not succeeding on any level. And when people come in and talk about all the policies that they're going to pass, I don't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if I talk about climate, I say it's my number one priority. I'll declare a state of emergency. I will use emergency powers of the presidency. I know other people may care about climate, but if they have a plan on the shelf that they're waiting for Congress to pass, we've been waiting for 30 years for Congress to pass a climate plan. Hasn't happened. So we don't have 30 years. I'm saying, look, I'm going to tell the truth and I'm going to take action across the board. You know, there's no one else on this primary who is willing to say they're for term limits for Congress people and senators. They won't even say they're against it.
Mm-hmm.
They won't even mention it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm talking about having Americans have the right to pass our own laws, to put it on the ballot, direct democracy, because it's so broken. That may be the only way we can get the things right.
Tom, good to see you.
Chris, it's always a pleasure to see you too.
This is Hampshire. That is Tom Steyer. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. Up next, a conversation with Joe Walsh, the long-shot Republican who is primarying Donald Trump along with Bill Weld. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Ryan. Appreciate you joining us for the show. Well, there are two Republicans who are going to challenge Donald Trump in the Republican primary here in New Hampshire. One is Bill Weld. He signed up for the First Nation presidential primary earlier this week. And the one is another one is even lesser known. He is former congressman and radio talk show host Joe Walsh from Michigan. And I spoke with him upon signing up for the primary on Thursday. Joined by former Congressman Joe Walsh, just signed up to run for the First Nation presidential primary on the Republican side, primarying President Trump. And you're talking about a lot of the challenges that exist for any candidate that is going to run because so many Republican primaries are being canceled by state parties across the country. Does that render your effort being one that is largely ceremonial, or do you think you actually have a chance to win given those dynamics?
I think we have a good chance to win. I really do. I think a lot of people don't realize it. I think everything the party establishment is doing to protect Trump is pissing off Republican voters. It's up to us to let voters know what Trump and the party are doing.
So you don't view it as being a ceremonial effort. You think you could actually win? Or how would that kind of play out, though, in terms of the actual math dynamics?
Here's the deal. This is probably the most difficult thing I've ever done. I would never do this if it was just ceremonial. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't put myself through this. So, yeah, we're doing it to win. Look, there are a lot of states, the four or five states that canceled their primaries. There is legal action against those states. Right. So we'll see if that's permanent. But there are 50-some states in this country. So, and we think and we know that Donald Trump is unpopular in a lot of states. So we think we have a decent chance to make it interesting.
So to make it interesting, yourself and Governor Weld are currently running. Do you see, as Governor Weld has mentioned, perhaps if one person is doing better than the other, that you throw your weight behind the other individual?
There needs to be one alternative to Trump. Right now, there's, as you said, Weld and Walsh. I think this will work itself out. We've got Iowa, New Hampshire in a couple, 2.5 months. Let's see how things shake out after there. But I really believe, and I don't know what Weld thinks, there needs to be one alternative to Trump.
A lot of your discussion about Trump was basically who he is and the danger that he's causing to our nation, both in the short term and in the long term. Do you think that that has to be the primary source of your message, or do folks have to know you to some extent?
It's a great question, and it's a difficult dance I'm dancing because I'm running only because of Trump. If it were any other president, it's not about issues. So, Trump is a clear and present danger. Part of what I've got to do is talk about why we can do better and talk about, and so here's kind of like the pivot. Because with Trump, it's all Trump 24/7, nothing else gets done. And I think the American people want to get shit done, and it won't with Trump in the White House. So that's a lot of what I talk about.
Do you feel that the reason that things are getting done is because of Trump, or is it a largely...
No.
It's because of Trump.
It's because of Donald Trump. All Trump cares about is Trump. When was the last time Donald Trump tweeted anything about public policy? Mm-hmm. When was the last time Trump tweeted or talked about anything other than himself? This is the Trump soap opera. It's his show. Mm-hmm. He's getting impeached because of him. Mm-hmm. The border's a mess because of him. We're not rebuilding our infrastructure because of him. It's all because of him.
Do you feel that this has been a wasted opportunity for conservative leadership? Because there's obviously a thirst for a change agent to come in and do something. And Trump hasn't really done anything, in my view, other than to create opportunity for himself and to make the story about him and such. So does that mean that an opportunity for conservative leadership on healthcare or on fiscal discipline, is that now kind of out the window, or can it be recovered in future generations?
It had better be recovered. It's like all Republicans now are just on pause. They're like paralyzed right now. They don't, because with Trump, everything's about Trump. All of my former colleagues aren't doing anything on healthcare. They're not doing anything on these issues. And again, I go back to what I said up there. They're all waiting for Trump to lose.
Mm-hmm.
And then they think things are just going to go back to the way they were. They're not, because Trump's not going to just leave the scene. That's why I'm so disappointed that so many of my fellow colleagues are not speaking out against him now, because they agree with what I'm saying.
So do you think that the Republican Party has been tarnished by Trump and
yes.
is going to be Trump for a long period of time and not to be reclaimed, and folks that feel it's going to change, it's not
absolutely.
Going to happen.
Absolutely. If we don't, again, if there weren't, I wish there were 1,000 Joe Walshes right now speaking out against him. Because of Trump, young people hate the Republican Party. Because of Trump, women hate the Republican Party. Minorities hate the Republican Party. He's destroyed the Republican Party brand. Because of Trump, most people now think the Republican Party is a bunch of bigots and cruel people. And if we don't speak out against that, it's going to take a hell of a long time to get these voters back.
Are you surprised that it is just you and Weld? I mean, Kasich
yeah.
was here.
Yeah.
And it seems like one of the major challenges of this time period is whether it's voter apathy or political apathy, in that there's opportunity to step forward and lead by a Romney or a Kasich or Ben Sasse, or I could go on for a long period
yeah.
of time, but there's this timid nature of folks, and Trump just seems to kind of be able to steamroll all of these individuals into, you know, submission, it seems.
Trump's a bully. Bullies are cowards. The most disappointing aspect of all of this is that a bigger, better name than Joe Walsh didn't step up. I wrote an op-ed in the New York Times 3-4 months ago telling somebody to step up. The Ben Sasses, the Marco Rubios, the Mitt Romneys of the world, they all believe about Trump what I say. The fact that that nobody else has stepped up to challenge him is really, really disappointing.
So what do you think, you know, let's look ahead to 2024 and where the Republican Party is at that point. We've talked about the fact that it's going to be very difficult for Republicans to evolve outside of it. Do you think there's going to be a thirst in the Republican Party, given Trump's popularity, for something that resembles him? I think it's more likely one of his kids that would run for president in 2024. Pence. Or do you think there's going to be a look for a clean split from Trump?
Look, let's always remember this. The country was divided before Trump. And I would argue it's the divide that helped create Trump. Trump has done nothing but make us even more divided. I think there is a yearning, because of Trump, there is a yearning for Republicans, principled conservatives, to stand up and be an anti-Trump. Talk about freedom, free trade, opportunity for all. And I think this is where the Republican Party has to go. And I think it's where the Republican Party will go.
Final thing, just in terms of kind of a process thing
yes.
in New Hampshire, do you view yourself being in New Hampshire kind of a continuous basis leading up to the primary? You're going to split between Iowa and New Hampshire. What do you view as your best strategy moving forward to make the biggest impact in the two early states?
I'm in Illinois, so Iowa's my neighbor. I think I'm going to hop from Iowa to New Hampshire, Iowa to New Hampshire. I want to put up a really good number in Iowa. I want to surprise Trump, and I want to surprise people in Iowa, and I want to do the same thing in New Hampshire. Bill Weld is known well in New Hampshire, so we intend to do very well in New Hampshire as well. But to go back to one of your original questions, coming out of Iowa and New Hampshire, there better be one clear alternative to Trump.
Right.
I intend to be that alternative.
And final thing is, for undeclared voters here in New Hampshire who are going to make a determination as to which primary they're going to vote in and may decide to vote for, you know, Joe Biden or Pete Buttigieg because they think that would be the best alternative to Trump as opposed to voting in the Republican primary, what do you say to them and say, oh, it's a better thing to vote for somebody that's going to finish second but is going to, you know, make an impact in this primary versus having a better Democratic candidate?
Independents, Democrats, Republicans, everybody should cross over and vote in the Republican primary in New Hampshire and vote for Joe Walsh, because I'm their first shot to take out Donald Trump. I'm their first chance, their first opportunity to really put a wound onto Trump. That's the case we're going to make. If you want to take a shot at Trump, I'm your first chance to do it.
Congressman, thanks for your time.
Thanks, man.
Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Yep.
That is Joe Walsh. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. Thanks so much for joining us for the show. For Paul Steinhauser, I'm Chris Ryan.